Dr. Janet Jacob Erickson, who is a researcher specializing in maternal well-being and the influence of non-maternal childcare on children's development. She completed a PhD in family social science from the University of Minnesota in 2007, following which she became an assistant professor in the School of Family Life at Brigham Young University. During her graduate work, she completed a social science fellowship at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., where she helped provide research analyses on non-maternal care to policymakers. She's married to Michael Erickson, and they are the proud parents of one daughter. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Erickson.
Thank you, and sorry that you've been hearing us all day. But we have a little one who doesn't like to crawl, but she loves to talk, as you could tell. It's a pleasure to be here. And Michael and I, as we were talking about interacting with you, both of us just mentioned how impressed we are with you as students. And as I start, I want you to know that you make a difference. Sometimes it can feel like it's overwhelmingly the other view that's pervasive around you. I once heard a professor that I worked with closely at the University of Minnesota talk about cultural change. And he said, Janet, every time a person does anything, it's carried 20 by 20 times out there. The comments that you make, the way that you live, making a comment to someone that would invite them to think differently about cohabitation, choosing to live a virtuous life yourself, and demonstrating that, all of those things are powerful influences, far more than you recognize. And you really are the key to cultural change. We depend on you. The future depends on what you offer and what you study and what you care about. The other thing is, I want to tell you just a little bit about my life as I start on this question of, does having a mother really matter? I am one of 11 children. I'm the fifth, and I have 8 sisters. So I have grown up with many women and talked a great deal about issues surrounding motherhood and womanhood. I completed my PhD, and I was working as an assistant professor for a couple of years before I met my husband, Mike. We were both 34 when we met. There's hope for all kinds of people out there. And he grew up in a family where his family experienced divorce, and I grew up in a big, intact kind of family. And it's been just a great experience to be together and to see different perspectives. And so those of you who come from families where you might feel like, boy, I didn't have... And you know all of us are broken in some way, right? That's just the nature of being mortal. That those of you who might feel like, gosh, I'm pretty broken, I want you to know that there's a lot of great hope, and that your interest in these issues and your efforts to help others are really important, and they make a big difference. And so after working for a couple of years as assistant professor and getting married to Michael, we were able to have our first child, and I had those questions of work and family. I studied work and family. I did quite a bit of research on work and family. I knew what it was like for mothers, and I want to tell you what a joy it has been to be home full-time with our daughter. And I am so grateful for the opportunity that is to be home with her. And those of you who wonder what you'll do, it is so busy. I thought as a single person I was incredibly busy. Life is busy as a single person trying to do school. And then it just seems to get busier. And then as a mother, you figure out how to multitask at levels you never realized were possible before. And I find that having had an education and opportunities before marriage has only strengthened and enhanced the opportunities after being a mother and being at home. There are so many different ways to contribute that you will find. And so those are just thoughts about that. Now, having said that, I have a sister who is recently divorced. She's a mother of 6 children, and she has had to go back to work. And sometimes we find ourselves in that situation as well, in that difficult situation. And I'll refer to her as I talk about the consequences of non-maternal care in this discussion, and hopefully give hope to those of us that experience those kind of dynamics as well. So here's this title, the question we never thought we'd ask. And the reason that I say that is because I think generations past could never have imagined we would actually question whether it mattered to have your mother care for you. Because, of course, one of the great tragedies in the past, one of the most important tragedies that could happen in a child's life would be to lose a parent, and particularly to lose a mother. But in a recent study in our premier journal in the School of Family Life, there's a journal called the Journal of Marriage and Family, February of 2010, there was a study released, and this is what it said. It said, we are in the process of deconstructing the essential father-mother, meaning whether or not, in fact, fathers and mothers are essential. And then the second point was, Researchers agree that men and women parent differently, but do not agree on the sources. You've heard about biological sources. You've heard about socialization sources. We don't agree on the sources, the fixity, how fixed those differences are, or the consequences of those differences. So this study, this journal article was going to make this conclusion, and this is what they concluded. Two compatible parents provide advantages for children over single parents. So in other words, two is better than one, but then it followed with irrespective of gender, doesn't matter that it's a woman or a man, marital status, doesn't matter that they're married, sexual identity, which was a given in this particular article, or biogenetic status, whether or not they are biologically connected to those children. And this was their conclusion. We'll come back to this same study at the end of this discussion and what they were drawing on in making those conclusions. But it's had a loud influence in our area of study because the assumption has been it doesn't matter if they're biologically connected and it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man. So we just go back a little ways, go back to the mid-1900s, and we get this scholar in England named John Bowlby. Many of you have heard of him because in every child development class, you're going to study him. He was a scholar of attachment, and he was working as a psychologist with thieves, if you will, people who were incarcerated. And one of the things that he noticed was that every one of these thieves had at one period in their lives been deprived of their own maternal care. Their mother was absent. Either she died, they were hospitalized for an extensive period of time, and she couldn't be with them. And he started to get these notions about the importance of this mother figure in the lives of people in terms of their psychopathological development. And he said, children deprived of maternal care during extended periods, it could be a couple of years or more, lacked feeling, had superficial relationships, and exhibited hostile or antisocial tendencies. This led to what we call attachment research. And he was kind of our first theorist about that there seems to be something unique about this biological mother and her ability to attach in unique ways to this child, and that she was biologically predisposed to it. Now, this is before they could test oxytocin and other hormones in the body, but he was at that level. He was recognizing there's something biological in her that seems to make her able to connect in a unique way with this child, and that connection is critical for that child's psychological development. So what went on is a woman joined his research team, Mary Ainsworth. She studied all over the world, focused her work in Africa, and she looked at how mothers interacted with their babies. And she came up with this idea. She said, it's not just the fact that the mother interacts, but it's how she interacts that's so critical. And she called it maternal sensitivity. Now, sometimes when I use that word, it's hard to understand. Well, what does it mean to have maternal sensitivity? So here's a way to look at it. It's a mother's ability to detect, interpret, respond to needs, and to be positive, kind in her interactions, and also respect the autonomy of that child. Now, I studied this for a long time before becoming a mother, but it is fascinating as a mother to experience these thoughts and feelings. So I hear her cry, right? You've heard of this whole horse whisperer, cry whisperer thing. Try to understand what is it that she's trying to express, knowing that I need to respond to this cry. That's one of those key things, to detect it, to respond to it, and then make an effort to interpret it, to be positive in those interactions, and then this very interesting one of respecting autonomy. So you've got to let them crawl, right, out, and you've also got to make sure they're safe and protect them that way, and not be pushy in how you're controlling their behaviors, but also protective. What we found out is this continued maternal sensitivity, not just when a baby's an infant, but even through adolescence, we can measure a mother's ability to do these things still, that it's critical to that child's psychological, in particular, development. It's like a protecting blanket, in a sense. Now, this is what I think is fascinating. Now we have the capacity to observe a baby's brain. We can watch on camera what's happening in the development of that brain. And people have been able to observe, Alan Shore here, who cited 1994 publication, you can observe a baby's brain, the synapses kind of connect, and the formation of this right hemisphere while the mother's interacting. And he would say this, maternal sensitivity in interactions leads to the development and functioning of certain cerebral regions. In other words, it's core to that brain development. Mothers sensitively modify their stimulation to the infant. And people who study this would say, mothers are remarkably adept at this. They know when it's too much. They know when there's going to be too much stimulation for that infant, and they'll hold back. They know when there's not enough, and they'll modify so that it's just the right amount of stimulation for the brain to develop. Do you think women are aware of this when they're doing it? No. That's the most remarkable thing about it. You don't even know you're doing it. It's just, and that's what Bowlby would say, it's like it's innate. Especially if you've been shown that yourself growing up. Through fine-tuned inputs, she is able to match and synchronize to her infant's state, appropriately providing the optimal chunked bits of stimulation needed for the child's developing right hemisphere, doing it just perfectly. So this is the NICHD, the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development. This is their most recent conclusion about the importance of maternal sensitivity. It is the strongest, most consistent predictor of a child's cognitive, so their brain functioning, how they do with conceptual things, their social interactions, how they see other people and relate to other people, and their emotional development, whether or not they withdraw or they're aggressive in their behaviors. It is the strongest and most consistent predictor. Now, I'll come back to this as we talk through non-maternal childcare. So this led to questions, right? We knew about Bowlby's studies of attachment. We knew mothers mattered a lot. We could watch brain development. And so in the early 1990s, the United States funded a big study on non-maternal care. And the attempt of this study was to just really answer this question once and for all. Does it hurt children to be away from their mothers for extensive period of time in daycare? And you can imagine there were feelings all over the place about this, right? That it didn't matter, that it did. They wanted to really get at this and find out what it was that did matter. And when they looked at the findings, and you can imagine they're tracking these children. I always wonder what it would have been like to be in this study, because they'd come every 3 months, observe you as a mother interacting with your child, observe the father if there was a father present. They'd go to the daycare center. They'd observe all the interactions there. They'd do all kinds of surveys. It was really extensive. They did not want to leave any question unanswered. And when the children were 2 years old, it didn't look like there was hardly anything that was problematic about having children away from their mothers for an extensive period of time. In other words, daycare didn't hurt. So what do you think the media reported? Right? Women, you can allay your fears, not a big deal. Your children are doing fine. They're thriving. We know maternal sensitivity matters. This issue of time doesn't seem to matter. And we went along. Then at 4.5, they did another one. And this time, all of a sudden, there were all these findings that showed concern about this. What they found is that between age 4 to 5, where children had been in extensive non-maternal care, 30 hours a week on average, they had less social competence and cooperation, more problem behaviors, negative mood, aggression, and conflict, and that the effective hours spent there prior to kindergarten were comparable to the effect of poverty. Now, you know that in the policy world, what do we get really concerned about? People growing up in poverty, because it's very devastating. And what they found out was this was similar in terms of its effect size. Now, these are educated mothers. These are capable mothers. These are not low-income people. Their children are in daycare, and the effects of daycare were similar to what would have been the effects of poverty. And so there was concern about this. What's interesting is they've been following these children. Now they're 15 years old, these children are. And in third grade, they found out that these children had fewer social skills still. And then they had this other measure, poor work habits. It was harder to concentrate on school. It was harder to follow through with schoolwork things. Then in the sixth grade, they saw problem behaviors, but they were associated only significantly with center care. Children who had spent a lot of time in daycare centers. So that would mean, well, if they were with the neighbor in the local neighborhood or they were with grandma, it didn't seem to have the same negative effects that persisted, at least. So just recently, age 15, those measures in 2010, they released a study, and they weren't looking at the same things because 15-year-olds are experiencing different things. What they found out is 15-year-olds reported more risk-taking behaviors. Like, what would that be? That's things like drugs and alcohol and dangerous kinds of behaviors. and impulsivity, meaning they felt like they were less in control of their behaviors. Things were just acted out of impulse. Now, some of you grew up in daycare. My husband's one of those. He was in daycare a lot of hours. And so when I present these findings, I don't want you to feel like you're going to meet somebody and just be like, well, no wonder you're in prison, you know? But because, and I think that's why this is this other finding is really important, is that the way the mother interacts with that baby when she is with that baby is still the single most important factor. And so what we need to do when we can't control the factors of who's caring for that baby all the time is look for ways to strengthen her ability to be sensitive as a mother. And that's where fathers play another key role, and marriage plays another key role. Other key findings. So people said, well, what about if it being high quality daycare? We're talking about low quality stuff, right? What about high quality? And what they found is there's some positive effects. Even when they're 15, they could see some positive effects, but it was not nearly what anybody in the NICHD study expected. Quality just didn't show up. It doesn't seem to have the same impact. And then this third one that I think is even more important than it has been highlighted in the media especially, that as mothers are away from their children for a long period of time, what do you think happens to her knowledge and awareness of that child? And so that seems to predict a decrease in sensitivity for her. Now, when we look at sensitivity, we're looking at how the baby interacts with the mother as well as how the mother interacts with the baby. And so it might be that the child feels more distant from the mother, so they're interacting less sensitively in that interaction. But something goes on when the time isn't the same that affects her ability to sensitively interact. Okay, so I want you to keep that in your head, the power of mothers. And then I'm going to move to other stuff. So the big question recently has been, if gender doesn't matter, then can men do this thing? Can men be like mothers in this? If we think that mothering is really important, but we're also arguing that gender doesn't matter, it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man, then we're going to assume that fathers can mother in this way, right? And so recently a study released in 2007, it's one of the best, I think, on this issue. She interviewed 118 fathers who identified themselves as primary caregivers. Some of them were widowed, some of them were divorced, but many of them were stay-at-home dads, and they had chosen to be the primary caregiver while the wife went out and earned the living for the family. And she did a lot of work with them to find out, do they do it like mothers do it? So she talked to these fathers a lot, and interestingly enough, you might expect this, but all these fathers would say things like this: moms are more protective, they're more nurturing. They acknowledge this difference, and they said, she's different than I am in the way that she nurtures. Here's a couple of quotes. I think it's a spiritual thing. They were with their mom before they came to earth, meaning in the womb, this mother was connected to this baby. That's what men do not have, that extra, extra special thing with children. These are men who are with their children full time. These are these full-time father caregivers, and they're still acknowledging there's something about this mother relationship that I don't have in the same way. Mothers influence the processes of fathers becoming and enacting their caregiving. So this is what David Blankenhorn was talking about. Women have a strong influence on how the father fathers. And his relationship with her is key to that interaction, fathers with children. Fathers themselves recognize that. And so one of them said, you have to recognize that even as a stay-at-home father, you can never replace the mother. Don't even think about it. It's impossible. Here's another one. They would recognize that there was this something about birthing. There was something about this process of birthing a child. There was something about the hormones that happen. It's not the same. She holds the baby more to her body. She rocks the baby more. I love her and everything, but I don't hug her as much. She's not part of me as much. And we know from attachment that a baby doesn't distinguish themselves from their mother for a long time, a year and a half. We don't know exactly when it happens, but they see themselves as connected to that mother. I was there at the birth. This is another father talking. I was there for all three of them, and I had a connection with them, but she had her body transformed. And anyone that's had a baby knows that's exactly what happens. You conceive a child, you watch your baby, your body be transformed. You have a child, and your body's transformed. I don't think we can undermine the fact that women are connected to their children in that very physical, that very primordial sense. In my opinion, women have an edge in parenting. This is fathers who are stay-at-home fathers saying, she's got an edge in this thing. Whether you say psychological or hormonal or whatever. So that leads to the question, so then what do fathers do? And I'm going to add to what's already been shared about what fathers contribute, because this dialogue of what fathers do is the key piece in understanding what fathers and mothers do differently, if you will. We have got to understand what fathers do. And I'm going to make the argument that we have not been able to measure this very well. So as I share why sort of key things about what fathers do versus mothers, I want you to be thinking as researchers, going back to your universities, why is this hard to measure? Why is it hard to get at what fathers are contributing uniquely to children? And my husband and I, he's an only child, so I'm one of 11, he's an only child. He never watched anybody care for children. But and I watched lots of that, of course, within just a few minutes of having our baby, I was cooing with this baby, and he was tossing her. It was unbelievable. And I didn't even read this particular language until she was 6 months old, and I said, Mike, can you believe it? Here we are. Here you were doing all this tossing, and I was automatically wanting to coo with her and talk to her and interact in that way. So I want you to be thinking about these five things. I think they're amazing. Number one, fathers use play to connect. They connect with their children as well. But they connect in a way that's playful, while mothers will coo, talk, cuddle, touch that way. Second one, this is a father saying this, I get them out as much as possible. One of the things she found out is these fathers would spend a lot of time with their children outside, and they thought about it. They've got to be outside. They wanted them to be experiencing the outside world. They wanted them to figure out how to interface with the outside world. Mothers weren't as natural in thinking about that. And so physical exertion, like he talked about, climbing up to the top of things, that was really important for fathers to do. I like this third one, where, and you've already heard a little bit about this today also, where her response when there was an injury, or the child comes home from school and says this friend was mean to her, what do you think the mother does? She's all about in the moment, comforting, understanding the feelings of that child. The dad, he's all about fixing it. I got to fix this problem. And so he'll talk about the problem solving related to that issue before he will talk about the feelings solving there, where the mother will do that differently. And so fathers would call this strategic indifference. I'm playing indifference for the purpose of helping foster problem solving around this issue. Here's the next one. I'm willing to let these kids fail. Father or mother saying that. Yes, father's really big into this risk-taking. I want you to be able to face things. And so it might require some failure. And that mother, I know how I am. Failure, right? Protect them at all costs. That we don't want them to fail in any way. So you want to set up the situation so that they won't fail. Where that father says, no, they've got to risk it because there will be failure in the future. They've got to face that now. The last one, this dad would say as he was being interviewed, I tell my kids they can make their own lunches. You guys can make your own lunches. And her first response, I'll just show you in her quote after that, as she's hearing these fathers talk about this, is there's another sign, father's pulling out of fathering, right? They're wanting to just pull out of it and let their kids do it on their own, where a mother would be like, I got to be there making sure it's this and this healthy and this kind of lunch. They're pulling out. But instead, what she could see is this father's all about promoting their independence. And not just physical independence, but their intellectual independence, asking certain questions to get them to think independently and emotionally independently. And so her question was, as she looked at these things, are fathers offering protective care, the kind we think is important for children's development, or are they offering its opposite? Are they really pulling out? And here's her quote. My first interpretation was that this was an evidence of the father letting go of his child, in contrast to dominant understandings of nurturing and protective care that suggests that the parent is connected to or holds on to the child. In other words, we have defined nurturing in one dimension in the science, and that is that it's always evidenced in holding on to that child, in protecting the child. So she follows it up with this. Gradually, however, I came to view this behavior as an integral part of nurturing. That is, the protective care of children with its qualities of attentiveness, responsiveness, and competence involves just what you were saying, David Blankenhorn, involves both holding on and letting go. And it is the careful letting go that fathers demonstrate particularly well, and mothers don't, she could have said. Mothers don't. So this was her conclusion to this question of do men mother? She says, I'm going to come back to the first bullet after I talk about the last two. Fathers experience profound moral transformations in caring for children. We know mothers do, by the way. We know mothers are put on a trajectory of selflessness and giving as soon as they have a baby. That's a pretty strong trajectory. When fathers care for children, they also experience a transformation. She described it as hard edges are softened. They recognize the value in caring work like dishes and wiping noses and diaper changing. They articulate a commitment to taking on women's work. But then here was her conclusion after all this study. But these fathers are not mothering. And they are not mothers. They are reconfiguring fathering and masculinity. They are not becoming mothers in the process. The first bullet was kind of referred to earlier today when you heard about this strong pull that mothers have toward mothering, like all of you women commenting on our baby, right? Naturally, our eyes are drawn that way. That's biological. That's what Bowlby would say. That's as innate as anything. And not that men don't do that also, aren't drawn to children also, but it's different. But she would say this, what she found out when fathers were taking care of their children full time and the mothers were out in the workforce, it wasn't like they switched. We might think about it as kind of a switch. Well, she's now working, she looks like a father, and he's now at home, he looks like a mother. What she found out is that mothers still feel very pulled. And when they come home, they feel this strong pull towards mothering, and so they talk about it as shared caregiving. Women who are working full-time and have fathers that are stay-at-home, they'll talk about it as shared caregiving. They don't talk about it as a role reversal. And she would say that's because there's a profound pull to nurture those children that she feels, even if she's the primary breadwinner and is away a lot, she still feels like, I have got to be there. And so the way mothers would talk about it is they'd come home and they'd say, I'm there. I am fully there because I care about how these children are doing and I feel a pull towards this. Okay, so here's the study in 2010 by Bibb, Larson, Stacy that got all this hoopla about it because they said, look, the research shows it doesn't matter if it's a mother or a father. It just matters if there's two parents. And this is what they decided to do. They decided they would compare studies that looked at single fathers versus single mothers to see do they parent differently. They'd look at differences between married wives and husbands. And they'd also look in a smaller group of studies, they'd look at planned lesbian co-parent families, so two mothers, versus a heterosexual married parent family. Now, the studies do not show that the relationship between the children of the heterosexual couple was biological. They weren't necessarily looking at biology there, but maybe adoptive parents versus lesbian adoptive parents, okay? No studies of planned gay fathers included child outcomes, and therefore we have, when people argue that it's the same, I want you to know, we have zero studies of motherless parenting. We have studies of fatherless parenting, the outcomes of that, of two lesbian women. We have zero studies that look at two fathers parenting and the outcomes of children there. And what they found out is, I like how one woman talked about this study. She said, their conclusion was, women and men are equal, except women are better. They're just better. They're better parents in this whole thing. And really, essentially, though, the study argued that gender didn't matter. It was coming up with this idea that the ideal is to have two mothers because mothers are good at this nurturing thing. So they looked at female parents more than heterosexual men, and they found out that female parents, more than their husbands, were aware, they were concerned, they were problem-solving issues about schoolwork and things like that. They seemed to be more available. They showed more respect for their children's autonomy. There was warmth, affection, attachment, interaction. And so you get this high dose of what we'll look at as lots of middle-class feminine parenting. So we're looking at what mothers do, and we're showing a lot of it, particularly when you have two mothers versus a combination of a mother and a father. So when they looked at two mothers, they found there was more time in imaginative play and domestic play, more activities with children, less limit setting, disciplinary control, emphasis on social conformity. And the assumption is all these things are really good, clearly really good. that parenting at its best is a very feminine looking thing. It's a very protective kind of thing. It's a very nurturing thing. And so what you find out is fathers and what fathers offer are not even included in the measures as being valuable. Now, part of that might be because when we look at young children, there's a different dynamic going on between the father and mother and how they care for young children versus how children are when they are older. So this woman who did studies on stay-at-home fathers, Andrew Doucet, she would say, as she looks at how emotionally connected mothers are, she found out over time, children come to their fathers for other things than they go to their mothers. And fathers, so as they get older, they want to figure out, how do I negotiate this world that I live in? Dad, how do I get a job? How do I do a resume? How do I take care of this whole thing? And who do you think they go to? Dad. And that his emotional work there is something that fills a huge hole that that mother can't often give in the same way. And so this emotion work that a mother is doing when children are very young seems to look different as the children get older. And fathers and mothers take a different kind of, if you will, they fill in different parts of the pie in caring for children as they get older. Now, part of what we're seeing here is there are no measures for that kind of thing. There's no way to identify what are fathers uniquely contributing. So, of course, we're going to come up with a conclusion. If we're measuring parenting in terms of feminine, nurturing kinds of traits, we're going to come up with the thing that, well, two mothers are better than one, right? Because you're getting a double dose of this middle-class mothering going on. And then when we look at single mothers versus single fathers, this is their conclusion again. So mothers are better. Mothers spent more time with their children talking and participating in school-related events. They displayed more affection and warmth. They knew the names of their children's friends better than the fathers. They had more rule-setting and supervision. They had less difficulty monitoring children's school progress and health habits and friends. They had lower rates of delinquency. The children did of these mothers than single fathers, and high attachment security. Now, the big question comes up with this one. How did this mother end up being single versus how did the father end up being single? And it also highlights that fathers are more connected to their children when they are what? Married to the mother of those children. Fathers, that dynamic, that relationship between the wife and the husband has a lot to do with how he fathers. And so you're going to see differences when you look at single mothers versus single fathers in terms of these outcomes. Okay, so I already told you that one of the statements is, well, men and women are the same, but women are better at this parenting thing. Here's the quotes from that study. We do not yet have comparable research on children parented by two men. And I told you, are there any studies on that? There's zero studies, okay? But they said, but there are good reasons to anticipate similar strengths among male couples who choose parenthood. Now I have to ask, why? I've taken you through all the stuff that shows who's better. Women, right? Women are better at this parenting thing. And yet this is their concluding statement. We don't have comparable research to look at children parented by two men, but there's good reasons to anticipate similar strengths among male couples who choose parenthood. And they base that assumption on this idea that gay men parent in ways that are closer, they think, closer to lesbian women than to a heterosexual couple. And that conclusion is based on what they call more egalitarianism, meaning these two men will share caregiving more equally than a father and a mother who are heterosexual, right, where he's working and she's caring for that child. And that's supposed to be a bad thing. The assumption is that's a bad thing, this imbalance in the amount of time that children are spending with the mother and father. Two women parent better on average than a woman and a man, or at least than a woman and a man with the traditional division of household labor. So the assumption is it's the big problem is we've got this traditional division of household labor, and that's messing up family life. That's inherent to marriage, and so marriage is really a bad thing, and what we need are two lesbian mothers parenting children. I mean, that's essentially the take-home message. But you remember what I said first? The first statement really was, two compatible parents provide advantages for children over single parents, irrespective of gender. Even though their findings don't really show that. Their findings kind of show that mothers are really good at what they do. And yet we're concluding that gender doesn't really matter. Now, I hope this study raises questions about how we measure what fathers do, first of all. And second of all, how we talk about the needs of children. I want to just share quickly a story that happened in Doucet's study of these stay-at-home fathers, and then I'll come back to some of the findings about mothers again. But she was the one studying those stay-at-home fathers and interviewing them and asking lots of questions. And one of her thoughts was, well, these men, it's really kind of pathetic because in the culture that they're in, they're seen as, you know, kind of dumb because they're stay-at-home dads and they don't have all these rights that people should have if they're caring for children. And we really ought to get out and advocate for stay-at-home fathers. And so she had these focus groups where she was trying to generate these questions about rights and to get our fathers to say, you're right. We got to switch this cultural value about motherhood and value stay-at-home dads for what they do. And so she's trying to get them to do this. And she describes how, as she's standing there doing that, she asks them this question. In an ideal world, what resources or supports would you like to see for single fathers? And she's waiting for, gosh, you know, some social support, some money maybe, whatever, some extra value. And this is what finally, it was quiet for a little while. She says, one man stood up and he kind of spoke for the group. And he said this, an ideal world would be one with a father and a mother. Now, these are primary caregiving fathers, many of whom were single because of various reasons. And then he went on to say, we'd be lying if we pretended that wasn't true. How can there be an ideal world without a mother for the children? And it really quieted her. And her thought was, these men, they seem to believe that the world needs both. And that even though they are doing the best that they can, that's not what they would see as the ideal. And her conclusion was, there's this remarkable intertwining of mothering and fathering that's necessary for children. I wanted to just end with some of these conclusions and show you what the other key factor in motherhood is, which is that relationship with her husband. We've talked about how a wife married to a man helps him with his fathering, but you could say the same about mothers. They're influenced in other ways with being connected to the husband, the father of those children. So here's our conclusion. There's a belief in a deep-seated difference in caregiving styles. Mothers seem to have a greater propensity for emotional connection. They do some kind of emotion work that's unique. But individuals and couples who move back and forth in their views as to who is more nurturing, in which context, and at which times. In other words, fathers seem to do a certain kind of nurturing at particular times in that child's development that's essential that mother cannot do. And it's rooted in the ages of children. When children are young, it looks different than as children age. I remember reading, David, I think this is in your book, Fatherless America, but there was this funny quote where he says, for the people who advocate for this sort of ideal of mothers being, fathers being more like mothers and men looking more like women, they envision a chronic world of babies in diapers. It's something like that. In other words, if men would just get their act together and change half the diapers, life would be better. But what they weren't envisioning is that future where children don't need diapers changed. They need help getting a job and getting into universities and interfacing with the world outside them. They need a dad. They need a man. And so when we talk about measuring emotion work and how mothers take care of children, so often we leave outside the picture what that remarkable contribution is of men and how essential it is for their development. We haven't measured it. Okay, so do mothers need husbands? Do they need fathers? Well, more and more we get this image of, you've seen in the hookup culture dialogue, Dr. Rhodes talked about what happens to women when they experience that hookup culture. It's devastating. Emotionally, physically, it's devastating for them. Well, do you think that ends in college? So what we find out is mothers who are in chronically repeating relationships, they have little children and there's a guy moving in and a guy moving out, another guy moving in, another guy moving out. Do you think it affects their parenting? Well, we know maternal sensitivity is really strongly related to marital status. Mothers who are being cared for by a loving husband are in a much better place to give the kind of maternal sensitivity that children desperately need. Maternal stress and the quality of mothering is really strongly related to mother's relationship changes. So how she's experiencing her own romantic relationships is spilling over into how she does parenting. It's also related to financial security. I've also done research on this gap between what women want to be doing in terms of work and what they're actually doing. And there's a big gap, just like was talked about this morning with Dr. Rhodes, that my study showed 40% of women, 42% were working full-time, 40 hours a week, and only 15% actually preferred that. They were asked, what do you prefer? What are you actually doing? Only 15% wanted that. There were a lot who wanted part-time employment. They want opportunities. They do not want to be responsible for all of that money-making that's necessary for nurturing. Why? Because they're worried about the everyday caregiving of that child. And so the best thing that a man can do, his great work, is to endow motherhood, if you will. It is to enable her to do her motherhood so well. He protects that mother, and she protects the children. And he also does what I've shown. He also nurtures those children in his own unique ways. He's key in enabling her to nurture in the way that she can best nurture. That's why that traditional structure really works. She's cared for, and the children can be cared for by her because she is cared for. And just so you know, one of the things that will happen is people become very critical of marriage as being patriarchal and dangerous for women. But there's just a hands down, all the evidence shows, where do you think women are safest? Cohabitation, being single with a boyfriend coming in periodically, or marriage? Hands down, it's marriage. So we know that poverty increases dramatically outside of marriage. You've already been aware of those studies, but a never married mother, these are kind of old studies, but the same thing, it's evident all over now still. Divorce, marriage versus marriage intact, where is the highest level of poverty? And child abuse, much higher outside of those relationships, and wife abuse outside of marriage is much more likely. The safest place for a mother and her children is within the bonds of marriage, because that's how she can nurture life best, protect life, is within the caregiving of a committed father and husband. Okay, well, let's do questions. And bless you for staying awake all afternoon, fading in and out occasionally. Thank you. And I'll just kind of field the questions, but she'll help us get the microphone. So do you have any thoughts or reactions? Yeah.
When you were talking about maternal sensitivity, is there a difference between the biological mother and, say, a mother who adopted the child at birth?
Great question. With lesbian mothers, you know what's interesting? The mother who gave birth to that child, in the case that a mother actually gives birth, she's more connected to that child. But as you know from having adopted children, Mrs. Wilcox, there's a beautiful development of a bond that happens. And mothers who are sensitive in those interactions can be just as sensitive, right? But it is interesting in a lesbian relationship, people can observe differences in the way they interact, the one who gave birth versus the one who didn't. There are biological factors there. Do you have any thoughts to add on that?
Yes. They were, the bond would be the same, there would be no preferential treatment, you know, for the child, just as you would have a child who was born of two biological parents would receive the same type of treatment.
Isn't that beautiful? So one of the difficulties is when there's a difference, is what you're highlighting. So if they're both...
Right. So I could see in the lesbian relationship where there's one woman has a biological tie to the child and the other does not, that this disparity causes some problems. Mm-hmm. But in heterosexual couples where there's either both have no biological tie or both have a biological tie, there doesn't seem to be a difference
in the way
bonding with the child.
Yeah, thank you. Does that help answer that? Good. Thank you so much, Mrs. Wilcox. Other thoughts, even reactions? Yeah, right over here.
Just something I'd kind of like a little clarification on. Yeah. To play devil's advocate, you in part of your argument had, well, men take this role of kind of making them more independent, where it's more make your own sandwich, et cetera, mm-hmm. and so forth. and then moving them out into the world a little bit. It seems to me that it's interesting to argue that you're making a role out of a non-role. Does that make sense? And that if you're going to make a role out of a non-role, then I mean you can't. If you have that it's not a problem if you don't have a non-role, or it's not as big a problem. In other words, you said that with the sandwich example, if the kid asks the dad to make him a sandwich, and he says go make your own sandwich, well that's one thing. If the kid doesn't have a dad to ask to make a sandwich, then the kid still doesn't get a sandwich made for him, basically. Does that make sense? Could you clarify that a little bit?
So, in other words, that role is possible because the child's going to get a sandwich as it is? I don't know if I understand. I'm sorry. Is
refuse the child's request? So the father acted in a capacity to refuse the child's request. In that way, he was absent. You could argue.
Right. Well, and she was right. That's what she was kind of saying. At first, when she looked at it, she was like, "Okay, here's the absent dad pulling out of fatherhood." So
that might be what Martin's referring to as the non-role. Is that correct, Martin?
Okay. 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 Yes. So the children were eating, right? I think what she noted is where some people could argue that, okay, there's this dad is just, he's going off to play computer games while his child eats lunch or whatever, or makes their own lunch. But she was just inviting another perspective by saying, we could see this as he's pulling out, or what I came to see it myself as, she's saying, as this is a way of nurturing that's integral. This child learning how to make their own sandwich is important, and it's like the father could get a vision of that. That was different than the mother. Is that helping at all? Okay. Okay. Yeah, Dr. Rhodes.
Are there any studies about when lesbians have to decide about work family? Do they argue about who's going to get to go to work or who's going to get to stay home more with the baby?
I'm sure that happens. I haven't seen studies that looked specifically at that decision-making process, but there is so much evidence about this difficulty between who's biologically connected to the child and who's not. There's some evidence that way, and so I would probably that is an issue. One thing you should know right off, and Dr. Wilcox is really good at presenting this, is that lesbian relationships are very unstable, even when there's a child involved. So as they're promoting these findings, saying, see, look, this is good mothering going on, except half of them broke up within 5 years. Half of the couples. And these are committed lesbian mother. I mean, this is people selected into this group. They wanted to demonstrate their good mothering, that kind of thing. And half of them broke up within 5 years. So that's a problem. That's a problem in terms of children's well-being, because we know this whole in and out of connecting who you're bonded to is dangerous for them. Now, I've heard Dr. Wilcox talk about how it's almost like, even in countries where there's a lot of support for lesbian marriages, where marriage is legal and all of that, and these couples break up, they even found they lasted around 18 months. I mean, it was a brief period. It was like they got bored with each other. You're too much the same. I'm sick of talking about all of this stuff. I don't know, but... But there's something about the dynamic that doesn't keep unity. And one of the beautiful things about heterosexual marriage is its permanence. There's something about the differences between men and women, and when they are committed to each other, committed to the institution of marriage, that brings permanence. And if there's something children need, guess what it is? Permanence. That's critical. That's key to their development. That's what attachment research is showing us. They need permanence. They need to know somebody's there to care for them, and somebody who should be caring for them is there. Yeah.
So I know that you're from a big family, and I myself would love to have a big family someday, but you sometimes hear people arguing that, you know, looking down on big families and saying, oh my goodness, like a mother couldn't possibly adequately care for all of those children. How would you respond to that? And do you have any studies or information about mothering large numbers of children?
Yeah, okay. We've had lots of conversations, Katie, about this in our family. Or Catherine is a cat. Okay. And whether or not this is true, can mothers and fathers care for more than a small group of children? And I can just tell you, I have a sister who's 16 months younger than I am. We were number 5 and number 6. And when my mom conceived the 6th one, she was like, oh, this is nuts. I cannot do this. After Ellen was born, she said there was a friend there watching, and she just said, I'm sure this child is not getting enough of my attention. And this visitor looked over at Ellen, and she was surrounded by her 5 older siblings who were giving her a tremendous amount of attention, more than she wanted. And one of the things that I think is marvelous about families is that there's all this nurturing that happens from that mother and father, as well as from all the other children. Now, Mike, my husband, would say one of the greatest things you can do is give your child a sibling. Give your child a sibling. Give them 2 siblings. Give them 5 siblings, because they know the history of that child. They share that world in a unique way. The longest lasting relationship in the history of relationships is the sibling relationship. You're with those people from beginning to end. Dr. Rhodes is reconnecting probably with your siblings in a neat way. That happens. And siblings are a powerful influence on one another. And so while fathers and mothers are obviously key, we cannot undervalue the influence of the family dynamic in nurturing one another as a family. And maybe you would have, Danielle, some other thoughts, having 8 children. Just, I'm sure you've thought about that yourself.
Yeah, I don't have anything really more to add, just that you kind of summed it up. If it weren't for my older children, you know, we have 60-month-old twins, and we're expecting another one, which on paper looks absolutely insane, but it is all the older children who do so much great loving and nurturing of these little twins and of it taking care. And they're like little partnerships within the family. I feel like they're also learning how to be good friends to one another, which then will help them hopefully to be good friends to people outside the family.
Yeah.
But it's really been great.
Thank you. I think Mike, my husband, would also add, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on one child to be everything to their parents, right? I mean, it's very interesting how that wonderful gift of sharing this care for your parents and being cared for by your parents is a gift. Do you want to add anything? I loved that. No? Okay. Great question, Catherine.
I was wondering whether you could speak to the effect of the image of women upon mothering, and I refer specifically to the image of beauty that we're often given, is a sexualized woman in her 20s, who is definitely not looking like a mother, definitely not pregnant, and definitely not 40 years old with several children.
Yeah.
And whether there have been any studies on that, or if you have personal reactions.
Great question. I love to get students to think about the damage of the sexualization of women. It is profound. I mean, we know it psychologically has been devastating to women. When I say sexualization, I mean women being viewed as sexual objects. I've heard some people say that we see an average of 3,000 advertisements a day, and I'm guessing with Facebook and other things, you see way more than that. And that in I've heard different estimates, you could say 80 to 90% of them, women are shown as sexual objects, whether they're the shape of the bottle or their back is shown at some restaurant. I mean, just bizarre things. People find a way of putting a woman's body in there, and she's used as a sexual object. And not only do they not have, you know, blemishes, they don't even have pores. It's hardly, like you're saying, the kind of body that bears and nurtures life. And so in thinking of what you do on college campuses, and just in your own minds and hearts, how do you measure what is done in the work of nurturing life, the physical work of nurturing life? That creates bonds between a mother and a child that are immeasurable. I think about, you know, how people will talk about their mother. I've heard people say, my mom is like the sun, and she's always there. Or different ways of metaphorizing the influence of mother. That is because of hundreds of thousands of tiny acts of physical nurturing. That's wiping noses. That's giving drinks to. That's changing diapers. That's all the hundreds of thousands of things that do. That work is so undervalued, right? I mean, it's like, are you kidding? So don't ever look like you've actually done it. And I want you to just know that is the great work of life. Jean Elshtain, when she talks about the feminist movement, she makes this great statement where she says, women, what happened is we turned on the feminine values that had been sustained and had sustained moral virtue for generations. And then she says this. This is the feminist movement. Behold the new woman as the old man. There was nothing new about it. This is the old man. This is the devaluing of the nurturing kind of work of life, that sustains life. It's the devaluing of anything that was not career movement. It's the devaluing of political or anything that was not politically involved, right? She's saying, we've got to, if we're going to be true to our womanhood, we must sustain the values that womanhood represented. Selflessness, care, the kind of nurturing work that nurtures life, and involve men in it. They need it too. It saves us both. Yeah, I hope that helps, but I do. I get aghast myself at that.
Q&A session now. So can everyone join me in giving her another round of applause?
And if you guys want to move forward and in, you're welcome to. You're fine where you're at as well. But okay, I would like to open our final panel, which is a Q&A panel called Shaping Campus Life, How to Engage in Conversations with Peers. And I will be moderating this panel, which is a neat opportunity because I have been, I guess in representing Love and Fidelity, I have been touched by the questions and the comments that have been made today. It's evident, your convictions are evident, the way that you think through these questions and the way that you listen to the speakers shows great insight and wisdom and passion for these things. And our mission at the Love and Fidelity Network is to train, equip, and educate you with the arguments, resources, and direction you need to uphold the institution of marriage between a man and a woman, the unique role of the family, and the integrity of sex and human relationships. And so in light of that, a lot of the questions that you have asked have been personal, and they've, I think, been answered quite well. And there's probably more answers to gain from that. When the Wilcoxes were speaking, there was a point that they made that I think applies well to perhaps this panel, in that they said, a man and a woman should find the unique talents that they have, bring those. So it didn't have to be 50-50, but it needed to be equitable. And I think in terms of the questions that you've asked, that there we could approach it the same way, that in our communities, we can bring the talents that we have and use them to make the proper arguments, to find the right direction and resources. And so as you think about questions that you have from the content today and about the differences between the sexes and the complementarity between them, I would just encourage you to think in terms of initiatives on your campus, to think about practical questions, messaging, like how you would phrase things or ask these speakers. They are scholars, and they do this sort of thing, and they respond to it both in the classroom and in the literature. And so ask them ways that you can respond in a newspaper column or in a conversation in a dorm. Ask them, you know, how to respond to opposition, both when it's posed to you as well as when you just you sense what it is in a broader way. And with that direction, we'll open it up for questions. I don't think we have a runner. Could we get that? Okay. You do. And I'm going to still listen. Wonderful.
All right, questions. I guess I have a question of how you would suggest responding to professors. I'm an English major, and a number of my classes seem to evolve around reading text and seeing how the male characters are lacking and how the female characters would have been better off if they had never married. And I'm often the only one in the class who is arguing that the marriage is actually a good thing, and the point of the novel was to show the beauty of marriage. And my professors will also disagree with me, and kind of like, no, you know, the institution of marriage, not so good, and these women were only adding in marriage because that's what they were forced to do because of the times they're living in. So how do you respond to a person of authority in cases like this without being too antagonizing?
I'll take a stab. Just quickly, I know sometimes it helps to give people research findings, right? The Heritage Foundation does familyfacts.org, and it's a great search site for details about why family structure matters, why marriage protects children and mothers and all of that. But I'll just say, I don't think that changes people. And that usually what invites some kind of reflection or response is your own personal experience with the benefits of marriage, either in your parents or, and I don't even know what you necessarily draw on, except I think what changes people is being touched and reflecting on what they've seen in their own lives. And certainly there are painful marriages, no question, and people are hurt and damaged in some bad relationships. But our personal witnesses of the benefits of marriage can invite change. That's my experience.
The only thing I'd add, as a man who teaches in this area, I do find I defend the men a lot. I've got 3/4 to 4/5 women in my sex difference course. They really love this, but they've got all kinds of complaints about men. And I like to ask them these questions. First of all, I think the evidence is that lesbians couples get divorced more than homosexual couples. That's not a sign that women are that easy to get along with. Now, you want another sign? Who argues more with their roommates in college? The girls or the boys? Isn't it the girls? They're always having some debate, some argument with their roommate about this and that. The boys, it's fine. They don't have them. Who has more arguments? Mothers and daughters-in-law, or fathers and son-in-law? I think it's pretty clear it's mothers and daughters-in-law. So if women are that easy to get along with, why is it when you put two of them together, they have a hard time getting along with each other? So I think, in a way, it's a sign of complementarity maybe being helpful. In other words, women have these high standards for relationships of every kind, and they're always checking them out to see how they're doing. Guys are, fine, you know. And maybe it's a good idea to have one guy like that in the relationship, because if there's two people who are always thinking about how's it going, who's doing this, it may just be more intensity than we can take.
That's right. Lower standards, higher averages.
That's right.
That's right.
So at least maybe inviting those kind of questions, making points that way. I know it's hard. You feel like you're arguing with everyone, and that's...
One of the things that I struggle with is I have a group of friends who they've more bought into the culture of people not in this room, the hookup culture, and talking to them about like my own personal views and hearing about the stories that they have is hard sometimes because I don't want to say something that sounds judgmental, but I also want the best for them and like... I was wondering what you guys think about how to approach conversations among peers without seeming judgmental or as if we're up on a pedestal.
Well, I mean, I think almost everybody eventually wants to get married, including these people who are hooking up, and I guess... You could ask, you know, is this seem like a particularly good way of getting to know one special person? You know, it's not a bad idea to have a boyfriend or two or along the way and some serious dating just to see what that's like. And hooking up isn't really helpful in this regard. So it doesn't seem, even if you're not someone who wants to remain chaste till marriage, it doesn't seem like it would be a helpful way to help you kind of sort through what men are like and what kind of characteristics I'm looking for.
I would just think from the way you asked the question that you probably don't have that much to worry about because, you know, because they're, you know, sincerity matters a lot. And, you know, they say people don't care what you know until they know that you care. So if you are communicating genuine, you know, human sympathy for a fellow human being who is a friend of yours, it seems like that goes a long way. And so people don't like to be lectured either, you know, that kind of lecturing, finger-pointing style. So we don't do that. And we don't divide the world into the people who have the correct answers and the people who have the incorrect answers. People hate that. I hate that. Everybody hates that. But if you could, to me, not that I've always been successful at it, but if you can just avoid some of those pitfalls, which are actually pitfalls of hubris and pride, then, you know, you're okay because you're relating to, you know, as... You know, and you do have something to say, and it seems like it could be said in a good way. I know it's easier said than done, and I certainly, you probably all three been in plenty of situations where you get accused of these bad ways of communicating, but certainly important not to just be silent and intimidated by the surrounding world, you know, that's another problem when you do that.
I really like, sorry to add too, I appreciate what was shared. I was thinking certainly sincerity is the key. And I think sometimes what we might fail to recognize is how much they are like us. I think that's what you're seeing. These friends want intimacy. They want connection. They want marriage. Eventually they want children. We want the same things. And I think just compassionately recognizing this is what you want and I want too. And that the way that I feel like I can have that is to pursue a life this way. And I think what's interesting with the hookup culture is there's been some research showing that people think there's more hooking up than there actually is. I know that probably surprises you. But they think everybody out there is hooking up. Everybody's doing a one-night stand. Everybody's meeting in bars. And there's a lot of people who are not. But because of that influence of cultural paradigm, pluralistic ignorance, we'll call it, then we'll think, I'm the only one who's not doing that. And I think even just asking that question to inviting, there's so many other ways to live and that we all want to have this kind of happiness in our lives.
I would just add to kind of bring these together as well. I think one of the things that the greatest teachers I know do is that they ask questions. They invite you to think, and that opens up someone's both mind and heart. They start to really consider, especially when you ask them in a way that invites them to answer however they really do feel, as opposed to, you know, saying what the answer will be. Before I worked at the network, I looked to resources. I looked both at the Love and Fidelity Network and as I mentioned to David earlier, the Institute for American Values. I liked their tone. And so look to resources. Those may be different for you, but look to someone who speaks and writes in a way that you would like to. And then write. As you write, as these scholars have done prolifically, you will find that you have a voice, you know, and that you'll become even more committed to that voice and more comfortable with it and able to then engage your peers.
That's a good point.
Other questions?
This is a bit of an unusual question, but we, in taking our message to the world of our campuses, are often called hypocrites. But I'm specifically asking, what do you do? How do you promote the sanctity of marriage and the upholding families, like what we've discussed today, when the person you're talking to about it knows for a fact that you have not always acted in the best way to do that. And, you know, how can you still advocate if you have done yourself what we have not endorsed?
Well, to put it in religious terms that may ring true to some of you, ain't nobody here but us sinners. You know, really, seriously. Ain't nobody, there's no, so that's one of the things that is so, I think if you look at how a lot of the public debate in the country gets expressed now, that that sanctimonious attitude about I'm the good, I happen to be one of the good people. I have it all worked out. I'm just, I'm a model. And I have my wife here who's another model. And we love each other oh so much. We're perfect in pretty much every way. And we, we're just blessed. We're just so blessed. And if only others could know the truth that we know about how everything should be organized. I mean, it just makes your skin crawl, right? It's not, first of all, it's not true. None, it's just completely not true. And everybody knows it's not true. So, but I don't know. I don't get the feeling that that would be a problem for you all. Or, you know, I don't get the feeling from the way you're talking that that's the way you talk to other people. So, I mean, when anybody said that to me, I've always just tried to say as honestly as I can, well, gee, you know, if you're trying to tell me that, you know, I shouldn't put myself up as being a better person than you are, then I agree. I'm not. I mean, I'm not. You don't have to. It's not. That's not the question, is who are the good people and who are the bad people. And the question is not who are the smart people and who are the dumb people. It's just not the issue. We're not. That's not what we're having a debate about.
I would just add to that, I think anyone who has an opinion about anything, which is everyone, fails at some point to live up to whatever it is that they hold to be true or mostly true or, you know, whatever. So whether it's something about marriage or any of the other, you know, hot topics or something that every culture has always, you know, professed to be good for society, like not stealing or lying. Everybody's failed to be honest all the time, but we still know that it's good to be honest, right. And that you can never judge a good by people's failure to live up to it. Maybe you can start to judge it by those who have. So in like a religious context, you can't judge a religion by those who, you know, fail to live up to, who aren't charitable or any of these things, but you can look at the, you know, the those who really have, the saints, etc. If you want to start to look at specific examples, that's what you can do. But yeah, those are my two cents.
Yeah.
And we're inviting a culture of change, right? So wouldn't it be natural that, you know, some of us have changed, all of us have changed, really, but that some more drastically than others, you know, and we're living in accordance with that, right? So it's a good thing to remember. It's also good to remember, I think, in this, that you have a spectrum which you're operating on. And I think, you know, as we talk about it at the network, it's important that we are speaking to people who are fence sitters and that they just need to know that everything that's been shown today and that is being spoken of right now exists and that it, you know, there's light to what they already want to live. And so we're not trying to find the people who are our biggest naysayers and change, you know, them as much as the people that...
Seekers. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is a question mainly directed at Mr. David Hinkenhorn. And as you mentioned, you were an expert witness in the California case, and you also said that you personally felt like that the the gay marriage issue was over and we lost that issue. And I wonder why you think that we have lost. I've kind of had those feelings too. I'm a government major, and a lot of times when this comes up in policy classes, it's really hard to debate it with other people, because it often just turns into like a civil liberties argument pretty much. And right. They have a lot better buzzwords for their cause than we do, I feel like. And I just want to know more about your personal experience in that, and why you think legal options in the country are not working or won't work in the future.
Well, from the beginning, the issue has been largely framed in the public mind as an issue of civil rights. And civil rights is a vocabulary and a category that's going to trump, in this freedom-loving country of ours, it's going to trump other rights. So if the issue is one of civil rights, then that's pretty much the game's over. I thought a few years ago that it was worth making an argument to say that what if the question was, what is marriage and do we value marriage? And I think that argument has been made and lost at the on the issue of this policy change for two reasons. One is that the decision-making people in society at every level have almost unanimously and passionately decided that we must have gay marriage. You would need a search warrant to find one who doesn't believe that. Secondly, those people who do not believe we should have gay marriage will not say so. I never should have been a witness at the Prop 8 trial. There should have been 50, 60, 150 people from Ivy League, senior tenured professors from Ivy League schools, who all they would have had to do was say what they actually think about what is the state of evidence today. You know how many of them volunteered to do that? Zero. We have 300 million people, zero would testify. Why? Why wouldn't they go to the courtroom and be sworn in and say what they believe to be true about their own research? Answer, they didn't want to pay the personal price that would have been exacted against them in terms of just a very rough time. So they didn't. When the elites of a society have all decided that they're either in favor of something or they're not willing to say anything against it, it's over. Therefore, it's over. Therefore, end of discussion. And that's kind of what I think. Now, there are people who have a different point of view about this, including some very smart people who have been friends and colleagues of mine for years. So I don't want you to take what I say as the gospel on this. I could be wrong, you know, but in my own work, what I'm trying to do is think about how to be a person who tries to do something for marriage in a kind of post-gay marriage debate environment. It's not because I want that to be the environment, but because it just simply is the environment, I think. But there are people who believe differently, and you may be one of them. I'm really not saying I'm right. No one knows the future. No one knows the future. There could be all kinds of things happening, but I was just sharing with you my own thought about it, really.
So I don't think it's over. And one of the reasons is, well, you look at state struggles over this. So like what just happened in Maryland, how would you respond to that? So it was dropped from the legislature in Maryland, you know, because there was a lot of reaction once the word got out that this is a gay marriage bill. At least that's my impression. I don't live in Maryland, but the word got out and people rallied around this. We don't want this. And talk to their legislators. And that, along with lots of other indications, gives me a sense that there are people who care about preserving marriage for the sake of children to have access to their parents, their mother and father. So I don't think it's over. And I think if you want encouragement about that, go to the NOM website. He knows them all very well. Maggie's a great friend of yours. And Maggie doesn't think it's over.
If Maggie were here now, it would be a fist going right into my jaw. Yes,
she would be horrified that he said that, right, in a sense. And so I think it's important to keep courage about this. But he is a warrior who's fought for a long time. And so we're going to have a fresher view than he will have, I'm going to say.
I'm being sent out to pasture now.
No, we build on great shoulders is how it is, okay?
Oh.
We're not letting you go out to pasture. But I'm just going to bring in, we need a fresh view about this, okay? So go to the NOM website, National Organization for Marriage. You'll get Brian Brown's updates, and you see good things happen with people responding to that issue and wanting to preserve marriage.
All right, I'm glad you said that, because that is the other. There's the other side.
I might add here too. There is recently to the point of NOM. There's a recent hire there who is working with students specifically to help them write about the issues. So I can put you in touch with him.
I don't want to disagree. I mean, obviously, we're putting out two different points of view, but I respect that. And what you said is very powerful. I only want to say, as I wander off to pasture and chewing my cud, I just want to say that I am not embracing, I'm not advocating passivity, giving up, doing nothing. I'm just trying to think of what is the thing to do. So it's not a question of quitting or giving up your principles or anything like that, but I hear what you're saying, and it's a good point.
Thank you. Okay, so I had an interesting situation at the beginning of the semester. I saw what was being offered on our courses, the marriage class, of course, that perked up my ears because that seemed very intriguing. I didn't realize it was in women's studies when I signed up for it. That does have an effect, I found out. But it would have been...
It was the gay marriage class?
Polyamorous
relationship. We touched on that quite a bit. It was more the, I don't see the point of marriage class. It was the anti-marriage class is what I finally started to call it. It was only 5 weeks long. It was more of a test case. A senior was doing research for a thesis project looking at marriage education in higher education. So it wasn't directly just the marriage class. It was more researching different methods of marriage education and what qualified as marriage education. And it took us 2 weeks to even start asking the question of what is marriage. So it wasn't a very well-led class. But what I came out of it wondering, because I was kind of the black sheep in the crowd. I was someone who actually had parents who were still together after 36 years. My grandparents had been together until the day they died. You know, and I was pro-marriage out of like three people who were pro-marriage in a class of about 13 people. What I was met with was actually, like, my professor, for instance, has been in a committed relationship for, I think, 13 years, has two sons, and in my mind, for all intents and purposes, was married but was not married. And she did not see the point of marriage at all. And my question kind of kept coming back to her of, if you're living in a married state, what is essentially a married state without having gotten up to make vows, but you're in a committed relationship, why aren't you married? And she couldn't really answer that. It was more like, well, I didn't want to give up this, or it came down to a lot of selfish reasons. But I was wondering how you might be able to react and at least present a positive influence to someone who has been living in a married state for the most part, in the fact that they are together, they're committed, they have children, and they're raising them together, but does not see the point of marriage. And I could not bring in a religious argument, love, though I would have brought that in, because she's not religious. And to me, that was the missing link. But do you have any advice as to how to at least present why marriage might even be a good option for her?
Well, just quickly, and then I know that maybe my other panelists will want to say something. I I don't think I would say that they were living in a married state. They were not. There's living together and there's being married. And those are not the same. And, pardon? Well, just descriptively, what happens when you get married is that you make a public, legally binding vow that is shared with your community. It's public, not private. It has a legal and social dimension. You're not just making a private decision with your lover to live together or to have sex together or to bear a child together. You're making a communal, social, legal, public, formal commitment to one another that has religious and legal consequences, and therefore it is different. If it weren't different, then there would be no need to have marriage. Well, I think that probably... If people want to live together, they can. And there's nothing, I mean, I think there's something wrong with it if you have children, but, you know, it's a free country. But some people, maybe not your professor of marriage, but some people believe that the that the institutional quality of marriage that has to do with its communal and legal and public dimensions that are different from the purely private decision-making of the two lovers, they believe that those are actual differences. And lo and behold, the scholarship, which could have been reviewed by your professor of marriage, suggests that those differences actually play themselves out in fairly significant ways in every domain of life. And I have a friend who used to be a columnist at one of the big newspapers, and he said, you know, if my daughter came to me and said, would you lend money to my boyfriend? Or she came to me and said, would you lend money to my husband? Those are two different questions. And so I've spoken too much. I just think that the social and legal and public dimensions of marriage are what make it marriage. It's what distinguishes from a private love relationship. And if you don't want to do, I mean, you know what I mean. You can have a different idea, but I think the evidence is just overwhelming that couples who participate in this public thing think about it differently and have different outcomes. Their children, things happen differently for their children. And so it may not be true in the case of your professor of marriage who thinks that living together, you know what I mean? But it really is that way.
And so you can hold to that. Just hold to that because it's true. I mean, talking about what marriage does for the larger culture, why it needs to be a public thing, and because you're right.
That you know, that is attesting that even these two people ought to be together, and that, you know, they are who they say they are. Even just, I mean, most marriages, you have to ask that of the community who's there, the witness. But I found myself almost hitting a roadblock with someone who was like way past that step, mm-hmm. to the point that, well, I'm happily together, we'll always be together, even though there's just gut knowledge, I guess, that you'll always be together, even though there isn't a vow there. It was just kind of hard to meet in the sense that she was way past that already. The kids were doing fine, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know how to meet it.
Yeah. So I think that might be one of those times where you just decide who your audience is, you know, and if you have done what these speakers have suggested, then... you see it as something you learned from. You have a great opportunity to grow in your ability to speak about it, and you move on to speaking to someone who may be convinced, you know.
I mean, the analogy, wouldn't there be kind of an analogy for, you said, a couple of dentists who decided to set up a dental practice, and in one case, they just went into a building and set up some dental chairs, and if anybody wandered in, or maybe they practiced dentistry on one another, or, you know, maybe they, but they put no sign up, they didn't call themselves dentists, and they didn't incorporate as a dental practice. They were just kind of a couple of guys with a couple of chairs and a room. And they might be really good dentists, and they might be really devoted to the cause of dentistry, but it really is different if there's a sign on the door that says, this is a dentist, and it's a dental practice that has the formal setup is incorporated. There's all kind of analogies I think you could come up with between private activity that has no bearing on public and social questions versus a public activity that is publicly recognized and in which there is a state interest. I don't think it's too hard to grasp the difference between those two kinds of activities. Anyway.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. I had a question kind of similar to hers, where I found myself in a conversation with strangers online in like comment thread boxes on the issue of same-sex marriage. And one of the criticisms that was posed to me was, it's actually none of your business or none of any individual person's business what the state of marriage becomes. This sort of disconnect that marriage has become really a personal matter, and then there's a rift to the legislative element or arena, and there's kind of no in-between where the people that make up the state have the right to participate in that conversation. And so how would you suggest responding to that beyond the point that, well, we participate in the state and it is there for our good as well, so therefore we do have some vested interest in what becomes of that legislation.
Mm-hmm. I think David will have a lot of thoughts in response to that. One of the things I think to be clear about is that it really is about the definition of marriage. This question really is about what marriage is. And it's not about legislating how people live per se, meaning how people, whether or not they choose to cohabit as lesbians or gays or whatever, but it's about defining what marriage is, and that the state has tremendous interest in that, just as you've said, because of all the goods that we depend on that come from it, not the least of which is our future children. And that is the critical piece there. And so I think when we can keep it in the, even though you feel like we've gone beyond that, but when we can keep it in the question of what marriage is and protecting the definition of marriage because of the goods that we depend on for it, because of what it does for children, because of its essential nature, then we don't have to worry about, we're not talking about legislating what people are doing in terms of their, in terms of the way they live their lives.
Yeah. The simplest way I've said it, tried to say it in the simplest way, is if you change the definition of an institution, you change that institution for everyone who participates in it. Everyone. Not just gay people, lesbian people, straight people. You change it for everyone who participates in it. So therefore, everyone who participates in it has a right to have a point of view about that. However, I'll just tell you that having said that in one way or another about 700,000 times, it is overwhelmingly believed out there that why on earth would you have any, you know, would you have any reason to care one way or another about how other people do this? So we haven't made much progress in making this argument, but I think it's the only argument that can be made.
Dr. Rhodes, would you mind maybe tying that to today's discussion of gender, as well as just your suggestions regarding policy and that kind of thing?
Policy on same-sex marriage?
No, just you deal with policy a lot.
Well, I think on same-sex marriage, I think one can make a case that men and women really are different. And if you focus on children, it's, if I'm right, and David Paquette's got a terrific article on this, and citing some people who say, you know, it's because a lot of people, I think, especially women, think there's too much competition in the world, there's too much aggression, and they kind of think, even though they're not radicals, why can't my husband be more like me? And if you can show them that, in fact, that's a less successful parenting combination than if he's like the way he is. That just as I said today, you need on the one hand the enveloping love, come to me with the skin knee, and also something that's a little tougher and reminds people in the outside world, not everybody's going to love you or nobody to run to. You're going to have to learn to do some of these things on your own. And if since there's evidence...
Make your own sandwiches.
Right. since there's evidence that that combination isn't just as good but better for kids, that they get along better with their peers when they have both those things in their life, then I think it's hard to see how two women or two men can give you that complementarity.
I think we have time for one or two more questions, depending...
Is it helpful in the conversations that you've maybe had, you were saying that it's not very effective to say that it affects all of us that are involved in the institution of marriage. Is it helpful to approach it from like a child's rights perspective where you say, you know, a child has a right to a mother and a father? I don't know. Is that compelling to people? I don't know.
It should be.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. I really thought that was going to be such a powerful argument. I still think it just has everything going for it. I mean, for goodness gracious, it's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is something that is fundamental. So I'm with you. It's there. But it has not made any headway in the public argument as far as I can see.
I would just echo that I think it is a compelling argument. And Brad Wilcox actually has an interesting piece on this in the context of artificial insemination, because we're getting to the point where there's now people 18, 20 years old, and they're beginning to speak for themselves and to say, who decided I didn't need a father?
Right.
Or sperm donations and so on, desperately trying to find their father. Who decided I don't need to know my father? You know, they're obviously very, very hurt about this, to kind of collect those people and their testimony and present it somewhere, I think would be rhetorically very effective. But obviously it has something to do with the same-sex marriage debate, because you're again talking about people deciding that I didn't need a father.
Problem is that when you argue for the rights of children, those rights are in some degree in tension with other alleged rights. And the fundamental right, in contrast to this right of the child, is the right of adults to form families in any way they choose. That is alleged as to be a right. And in our very... in our society today, that right of the adults to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it, for whatever reason they want to do it for, trumps the right of the child to know her parents.
I think in personal conversations where people might disagree on this issue, I think that one does get some people. What about your own personal feelings as a child?
Yeah.
What would you want to have? You'd want to have your mother and a father. And I think... in this same-sex marriage debate, one of the things that the research is really underdeveloped on that side, and one of the ways it's underdeveloped is what we're getting from in vitro, you know, sperm bank findings, is that when people want to form their own families, that's when all these issues come up, right? I don't know who I'm passing on a heritage to because I don't know my own heritage, and we're not seeing the effects as obviously until it's time for them to form their own families. That's why the longer people delay marriage, in a sense, the more we have this group who's disconnected from children, and the rights of children, and they would be more inclined to say it's about me and my rights than as a parent they would feel for the what their children they would want for their children to have.
I might pose one more question off of Catherine's, in that emerging adulthood is you know studied and coined as this term for 18 to 25 year olds who Erickson's theory of generativity is sort of the ultimately in development that you will want to give back to society and to give to children. This extended adolescence isn't a time when that develops, and so so in my own studies I've wanted to show, I guess, that there are some emerging adults that have these generative feelings. And the scholar of emerging adulthood told me no, like it's not possible. And so so I wonder what differentiated the generation, you know, or to be previous to ours then. Because if it's a part of human development that you just don't think about the children of the next generation in this age group, why did people used to think about it, you know? And what can society, like, how can society teach 18 to 20 year olds, you know, that children matter? And what is the argument for it? Why do children matter in response to David's, you know, comment about why do children matter above the rights of parents? How is that good?
Well, I think whoever told you that this Erickson's concept of generativity could never be applicable to people in their early 20s is just mistaken. I mean, let's just start with that. That is a wrong idea, just empirically and just about every imaginable way, because our own history and the history of almost every human group shows that that's not true. Why we have evolved this new period of life in the 20s, I have to say, I don't feel qualified to say. Why? I think it has some advantages and some considerable disadvantages, but I don't know where it comes from.
But more, how do we respond to do children matter? No.
I just have a quick comment. I'm LDS Mormon, and there's been a recent talk about women in who are in their mid-30s and not married and who are not religious, who are kind of addicted to these Mormon mommy blogs. And they like to get on and see how Mormon mothers are living. And when they talk about it, when they talked about it on the Today Show, it was this comment of, you just don't even believe that's a possibility, like that people can be in these happy marriages and that husbands are kind to their wives and that mothers like being home and caring for their children and they like making cookies, that kind of thing, whatever. And I think one of the things is you give a vision to your friends about the happiness that can be and that it's possible to have that. It's possible to have committed relationships and that you're kind of a witness of this being a good thing and that children will bring meaning, as Brad Wilcox talked about earlier today, that transcends any kind of meaning.
That's great. Other questions?
So as a young woman in an engineering field, I oftentimes have conflicting like visions of the future because I'm being trained in pretty much like one general skill set. So there are, you go and you are an engineer. Like that's kind of the career that I see for myself. But then I also don't want to rule out the possibility of motherhood. So I was wondering like what kind of advice you could give for young women in a similar situation who really love what they do but also don't want to and really want to excel at that and find like meaning in it but don't want to rule out the possibility of family life. Like how do we like think through those things and talk about them with peers, like because our peers are mainly, at least at our engineering school, are mainly male. Yeah. And so they kind of don't have those problems to think about when they're trying to think about where they're going to intern or like what they're going to do.
Yeah, right. You can. Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one, because mainly because I don't know much about engineering, what the options might be. I do have a sister-in-law who's a scientist, a kind of a hard scientist. She has great fun teaching. Even just teaching science to girls, she's got this experiment where she shoots a Barbie doll into a garbage can. You know, the girls love it. But I just don't know whether this is a profession that where there's part-time work or not. And I think you ought to look into that right away, and maybe channel your if it interests you at all, channel some of your effort into that kind of engineering. I just don't know enough about that particular. I do think in general it's harder in business where people are transferred around a lot, and where there's less flexibility. Although I do think that if women are good and they've been there a while and then have a baby, they'll find a way to make accommodations for you because they don't want to lose you.
I guess I just have two maybe additional thoughts. One is I think it's great to keep that motherhood role at the forefront of your mind, and that is what you're preparing to be, and that your education and your training, your opportunities will only strengthen your ability to mother and to educate your own children and to be an influence for good in their lives and in the community. And so just setting that aside, though, I'm amazed at how innovative women are in terms of finding niches that are meaningful in terms of contributing professionally and being able to nurture and care for their children the way that they want to. And so I think as you keep that in your mind, you will find remarkable ways to do that. And you might find that your interests professionally change. So we were just talking at lunch about the ways that women contribute. Sometimes they'll come out of the workforce and stay home primarily with their children for a period of time. And they'll come back and they'll have very different interests than they thought when they were in college. And they're doing all kinds of uniquely contributing things that are so important in building communities. May not make tons of money, but they're really important in building communities. And they find tremendous meaning in that type of work. So does that help at all? It is hard. That whole work and family issue is very hard. I think don't be afraid to keep in the primal part of your brain, I am preparing, most importantly, to be a mother. And I think taking cooking classes, sewing classes, I mean, I think the things that you do to strengthen your ability to actually care for and nurture life are really important. And that you don't have to see them. I don't see them as actually equal. I don't see myself as a professional and a mother. I think I am a mother. And I also have some professional interests that I pursue, and I do, and I enjoy them. But this child depends on me to be their mother.
This is just a little tangent, really. I can't add anything to what has been said, really. It's just that when I, you know, I have a 21-year-old son who's thinking about graduate school and so on, and I don't know. It seems like there's a great deal of focus and intensity among young college graduates today about their career, and just so much, I don't know. I mean, another perspective is that life is pretty long, and you can do a lot of things. And the idea that if you like stop doing one thing for 6 months, that you're going to be forever lost in the big race of your profession, you know, I mean, all I'm really saying is that what I notice, and this could just be the more competitive environment that you're entering into, and the job. I don't know what all the reasons are, but I see a lot of worry that somehow if I am not full out every day without missing a day, without missing an hour, you know, but the idea that I would do something else for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years seems harder for people today. Maybe it should. Maybe that's just the reality. Maybe in engineering, that's absolutely the reality. But I'm just observing that it seems particularly acute in people of your age entering into professional training. And I just sometimes I ask myself, is it really true that you won't be happy if you just take some, like, think of life in a more sequencing way? I don't know. It's just a question.
I think you can have it all in that sense, but you have it all at different times. Yeah. The seasons approach is so beautiful. I think that's a great answer to see life in seasons. I don't know if that answers your question, though. Thoughts, I guess.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering if I could. I was just thinking about this topic of professions, and a question had come up earlier about my wife was asked about a large family, and I think they're often tied together, this feelings of how do I have family and how do I have my profession and how do they work out. And I was just reminded of something that my wife's father shared at a wedding breakfast for his 11th child. His last daughter, Janet's sister, was just married, and he was looking out at his family, and he was looking at his 11th child, and he was thinking about all of them, and he said, "Our family, I couldn't imagine my family without any one of them. It had been a sacrifice during many times for the family that they had, and to give life to so many and to provide for so many, but it wasn't a sacrifice in the end, and they were so grateful for all that they had." And I think we often we're taught so much as was mentioned earlier, to focus on our educations and our professions, and we've lost some of thinking about our families and planning for our families and having a very careful and deliberate plan that our professions serve our families. As fathers, my greatest role now is to be able to provide for my family, not to distinguish myself in some way professionally, but to be able to be, as my wife talked about, a provider that enables her, that endows her to care for our little daughter. And I'm grateful for that role, and to think of that position as enabling family.
That was a great closing remark to kind of bring it all together. Let's thank our panelists and speakers one more time.
Thank you all.
Carry on. You have lots of good work to do.
Okay, now Dr. Stephen Rhodes will provide our closing remarks.
I've been asked to say a little bit more, and you've heard an awful lot, so I won't take too much time. But my old opposite, Janet Hyde, when she complains about people talk about sex differences, she says one of the biggest problems is it creates conflict between men and women. He's from Mars, you're from Venus. How in the world are you ever going to talk to each other? And I'm convinced it doesn't, that it helps for better understanding. But to give you a couple examples, I had a graduate student in my class, and I went over the fact that men often don't look at people when they talk to them. She said, "It's amazing. I thought it was just a problem with my husband. I'm always telling him, why don't you look at me when I'm talking to you?" And I said, no, this is a problem. If you think about it, if you look directly at a woman and talk to her, it could be seen as seductive. It could be seen as threatening to a boyfriend or a husband. If you look directly at a guy and talk to him, it could be seen as, you know, also threatening in a different kind of way. And men just don't necessarily look, and they talk ajar, and they do things side to side and so on rather than straight on. So it was interesting to tell her that, you know, it isn't just an odd fish you've got. This is something that you may run into if you hang around with men.
I think it's the origin of the bow, don't you think? the old, when you bow, I think it's like, it's a kind of, you're not, it's an act of anti-aggression.
I hadn't thought of that.
I really think it is.
It could be. Another example, a personal example. My wife was having all kinds of trouble with the head of the rhetoric program at Hamden City College. And for weeks and months, she would come home and complain about the things he'd done. And I'd listen to this, and I'd make suggestions, as men usually do, and I'd listen. And then finally one night she said, "Steve, there's nothing anybody can do." And I said to her, "Why are we talking about it then? I mean, what in the world? We could be watching a movie. We could be having fun in all kinds of ways. Put it out of your mind. If there's nothing you could do. And then I learned, actually, from this sex study, that women get something out of talking about things there's nothing they can do about. I mean, it still seems to me absolutely bizarre that anybody would want to spend their time talking about something that has no solution. But lots of women do. And then I was able to see.
I'm bewildered by it too, brother.
Yeah, I could see that it wasn't just an odd woman I married. It seems to be a general problem. Yeah. Not the one I'm thinking of, but here's another angle that I also went further. And do you know that there's evidence, and you should know, that if a woman in a white-collar job doesn't get along with her boss, that her husband is more than 3 times more likely to die of a heart attack. Now this comes out of Framingham Heart Study. This is as good a heart study as you're going to get through generations. Now I didn't know that, but that puts another spin on it, doesn't it? Now it's obvious why it's going on.
Another man is giving her wife problems.
Exactly, another man's picking on her wife. He feels like going out there. What can he do to his wife's boss? Absolutely nothing. Worse yet, he's got to listen to it every night. So when I read this study, I could understand, believe,
definitely,
how this was could build up and lead to a heart attack. So maybe I would think women would want to know this. Maybe they'd only bring it up once a week. They don't want to kill their husbands. So I think you can learn something from it. Now, but here is a problem. If women bottle up problems they have with their husbands, they die more often, more quickly. But they die more quickly. But the guys hate to hear criticisms, you know, whatever. They like to think they're trusted, they're a good husband. She realizes I'm a good husband, I'm a good father, I'm doing my best. And any little criticism, they don't want to hear it. And women have lists of criticism, of things that could be better. And all I can say is, how do you get around this? You know, there's lots of ways. Women can be very delicate if they want to. My wife is, you know, one morning she said, thanks so much for shaving today. I think you look great. Now, why did that come up? Because for a number of days I hadn't shaved. Now, she could have said, why don't you shave? You know, at least I try to look good for you. At least you could, you know. Instead, she said, thank you so much for doing that. Well, I got the message. It wasn't nearly as difficult to deal with. And when I'm driving her somewhere, and she says, are you going to park over there on the right? Now, some women would say, you know, lots of spaces over here, a bit closer, you know. But she doesn't say this. She says, are you going to park over the right? And it's always the best place to park. And I wasn't thinking about it. But then it's, yeah, sure, sure.
Right. Good decision.
Yeah. Good decision, yeah.
Yeah, I admire
look, there's lots of women can do this. Don't bring up everything on a list. Getting when he's not tired, talk about it quickly, don't talk about how all the other things he's done wrong. You know, there's lots of ways to make this right. And I want to end by really reminding you of Jennifer Robach Morris, a wonderful statement. She has this glorious article that I send to you if you want to ask me about it, about how she changed being the kind of woman she was, and lo and behold, her happiness, her marriage became much more happy. And she says, you know, I realized I had all these complaints, and I was always complaining, and it was about how he wouldn't do the important things on my list. He wouldn't do half of those important things on my list. And then I realized he's got a different list of important things to do. It never had occurred to me. He doesn't want to do half of everything on your list. He's got a different list about what the important things are to do. Now, that's an interesting insight, I think. And another insight is, you know, and it is true, you know, what do you do about the fact that you like a cleaner house than he does, which is what's typical? Now, if you say he should clean up half the time, well, in a way, that's unfair. Lots of guys are really into their cars, but they don't ask you to come out and help wax. You know, in some sense, if you care more about something, in a way, it's fair for you to do more of it. But in a way, it's if he cares about you and knows how important it is to you, he should be cleaner than he used to be and do things because he loves you. So it's difficult, but you can see that there's more than one way to look at it. But I want to end by saying I begin my class on sex differences often with a poll in which I ask women, what do you like most about men? What do you dislike most about men? And men, what do you, same thing, what do you like most about women? What do you dislike most about women? Now, the first thing I would point out is they never say, oh, I don't know, I don't notice much difference. You know, men, women, they have no trouble coming to a conclusion.
I
I haven't read the Biblar Stacy study.
Right. But look, I really think it's interesting if you look at what they say, how what they don't like is often the flip side of what they do like, and how it's hard to imagine you're going to get the good things without the bad ones. Here's what the woman said they liked about men. Strong-willed. What they don't like, arrogant, macho. Well, you know, maybe he overdoes it some, but in control, strong. Well, you know, he can overdo that. Easygoing. On the other hand, never communicates his emotions. Well, you know, he's easygoing because he doesn't have as many emotions. You know, he doesn't get all upset about things and always all these highs and lows. So, you know, do you like it? Well, if you like it, maybe you won't get as much emotional discussion on the other side as you might like. And in control, but never admits he's wrong, and so on. Sense of security and safety and protection, but he's arrogant. He's always sure he's right. You know, these things, it's hard to pull them off altogether. Now, what about men on women? Well, they say they're so sympathetic, they're caring, they're comforting, they have so much compassion. Well, what don't you like about them? They're so emotional. Well, you know, sympathy is an emotion. Compassion, you know, if you're compassionate and sympathetic, you're emotional. You're more emotional than people who are in control, you know, and easy to get along with and never get flustered. So I think it's important to look at at the good side more often than the bad side. That a lot of the things that you like in the opposite sex are somehow connected with the things you don't like. For example, I think women like a man who's, in some sense, he is a masculine man in the bedroom. He's a guy in the outside world that people pay attention to. But they'd like him to be an absolute egalitarian in every other part of the house. You know, it's kind of hard to pull off sometimes. You know, he's got a certain nature, and the things you admire, maybe a flip side, you don't always like them if they get out of hand. It's possible. It is possible to be a sensitive good guy in the rest of the house and still kind of in control in the bedroom. But it's not always comes easily, and I think to be more empathetic and more sympathetic and to try to look at the good side of what you're getting from this person who's not just like you is a recipe for good relationships and good marriages. Anyway, I think it's very impressive you all stayed so long and on a beautiful Saturday decided to devote your time to this, and quite impressive. I'm sure we all enjoyed it. Well, thank you for coming. Mm-hmm. Thank you.